what is the state of the public square these days? And do people feel like they can really give their real reasons? This person had very valid reasons, by the way, religious and ethical and otherwise, about what her position was. And she was very clear and articulate about it, but was scared to share that.
We're talking today with Dr. Brandon Edwards, co-director of the S1 Project. He and I are having a series of conversations for the What in God's Name podcast about the class that Brandon is teaching at the University of Virginia this fall. That class is titled Religion in the Public Square. The first week and the first show in this series was asking, what is the public square and what ails it? The second show talks about the law. Brandon talks about the law with his students and the wall of separation between church and state. Is it a wall or is it more like a chain link fence? Then our conversation last time, what should the role of religion be in the public square? Today's show is religious literacy. What role might religious literacy play, and can it be helpful in conversations about religion in the public square and a way to understand how to bring religion into the public square? So, Brandon, there's a little synopsis of where we've been and where we're going today. But before we do that, I want to just ask you this perhaps provocative question. But it's something that I try to remind myself of and also other people. What's at stake in these questions? What is the importance? Your understanding of it, but also what you're seeing in your students and how they are understanding the importance of these questions.
That's a great way of kicking us off, Chris. And it's good to be with you as always. What I want to say to start is that a reminder that I am requiring as part of the grade for the students to meet with me individually in office hours. And the reason I start with that is because office hours are a really great opportunity for me to ask them how they're settling it at UVA, but also to just sort of say, what are the big ideas that you're taking from this class? And what's something that's challenging for you about it? And by and large, I have to say, and this is not genuinely to toot my own horn, I'm surprised at the number of students who say to me, this is my favorite class, Dr. Edwards. Perhaps I am really surprised by that, but there is something about the course that I think that invites students to be able to talk about public issues in a way that they're really not used to. And I'll return to a comment that was made in the second week, which I may have shared with you, and if not, I'll share it again. A student asked me, look, we have the opportunity to talk about real issues in this class, but how do we actually avoid giving the answer that we know we're supposed to give? How do we stop being fake? And I think what that suggests to me is that students know that we are ailed by a sense of us versus them, and not simply us versus them, but a sense of I would be happy if that other group just stopped existing. And they're not happy with that. And they want some solution that allows for real conversation, real disagreement about public issues, and, dare I say it, an opportunity for there to be nuance. I have a really great story that illustrates this, if you don't mind me telling it for just a second. In one of those office hour conversations yesterday, a student of mine who is a self-identified Catholic and also a she says liberal. We were talking about the course and she said, well, it's just tricky because there are some views that I have that I don't really want to share in the big class because I'm a little bit afraid of what might be said about me. And I said, well, just give me an example of that. And she proceeds to put her hand over her mouth because we were in public and she sort of drops her voice and says, well, I'm a little bit pro-life. And I said, well, tell me more about being pro-life, because this has come up in the class a few times. And she said, well, you know, I grew up in a Catholic family, and I certainly grew up going to Mass. She said, but I have to say, there are certain instances where I think, you know, abortion is okay, and there are instances where it's not. And I can go further into the meat of that conversation, but what I really wanted to share with you that I think is super important is one observation, which is she felt, even though we've had a class for now 4 weeks where we are talking about public issues, that she had to drop her voice and cover her mouth. And that says something to me about what is the state of the public square these days? And do people feel like they can really give their real reasons? This person had very valid reasons, by the way, religious and ethical and otherwise, about what her position was. And she was very clear and articulate about it, but was scared to share that. And I think that's what's at stake. And I think the more that we do this and the more that we practice doing it, one-on-one like we were doing, but in this class, as we are trying to do, it makes it easier for students to be able to give those reasons and talk about real issues and potentially disagree without walking away hating one another and wishing that the other side just didn't exist anymore.
That's a really interesting story, and it suggests to me that what's at stake is being a self-governing people. If you aren't able to, just this image of the hand over the mouth and the dropping of the voice and the fear or discomfort of giving real reasons for why you might believe a certain thing, if all of that is in question and becomes shaky ground, then self-governance becomes impossible, because self-governance relies on the ability of the people to have these conversations.
100%. To have these conversations, to have them productively, and to see one another not as opponents, not as even less than human, but as equally powerful citizens in the democracy.
Yeah, and even though, like, we tend to gravitate towards the politics and the political machinations and making laws as the place where these conversations really need to happen, but that's not true. What really needs to happen is that these conversations are able to take place in schools or in public or with friends or even with family. Like, you know, just that there are venues that there are places that people can talk this way. My point is, it's not just about politics. It's about society being able to sustain conversations.
That's right. It's actually just about being together. It's what it's about. It's about being citizens and living together productively. And to that point, on a somewhat cute, humorous note, one of the students also told me yesterday that he told his parents that this was his favorite class. Mom grew up Catholic, dad's not particularly religious, and mom said, "Boy, I'm really glad you're taking that class." So I think this is important, and the students are taking this to different places. They're talking about this with their friends. They're talking about it in other classes. A few people have mentioned to me, for example, that they're taking philosophy and political theory classes where these topics that we're discussing are coming up there. And then to know that they're talking about it with their parents, this is what we want. We want people to be able to have to take this model and then take it to other people.
Great. Let's turn towards the topic of today, which is week 4 of the course that you're teaching. And just to set that up, we remember that week 3, one of the questions that Richard Rorty raises is religion in the public square, is any kind of religious talk a conversation stopper? And so we explored that a little bit. But here in week 4, The question is, you're introducing religious literacy. Religious literacy to the rescue, I think, is a phrase that you might use. So tell us about religious literacy and how it might come to the rescue. What is it? What might it be rescuing? But you don't have to start there. Tell us about religious literacy.
Yeah, let's start with religious literacy. And let me just ground our listening audience in the two readings that the students engage with in this week. So the first is a reading by Boston University professor Stephen Prothero, who has essentially defined religious literacy as any other kind of literacy. When you think of that word, what is the first thing that pops in your mind? It's the ability to read. It's to understand language. He basically says, take the same principle and apply it to religion. We need to be able to understand the central texts, the narratives, the heroes, the symbols of the world's religions. And in particularly, Prothero argues that in America, citizens need to know about Christianity because it has this sort of implicit bargain with the U.S. government from the inception in the period of the Republic. And so he makes this case that religious literacy is important from a civic perspective, that if we, for example, encounter references to biblical literature in, say, George W. Bush's first inaugural address, The Road to Jericho, for example, what is that and why does it matter? And what is George W. Bush saying when he evokes that? And what, even on a more deeper level, does that say about him, about our country? But the other thing that we do is we sort of critically look at Prothero and say, okay, let's just say for argument's sake that I know all of these symbols and heroes and texts. Is that enough? And that's where we turn to Diane Moore, who is my colleague up at Harvard Divinity School, who has a different way of understanding religious literacy. And her basic principle is that we need to understand religions not as a monolith, as you might argue Prothero understands them, or understands religious literacy at the very least. I don't want to misspeak for Prothero. But Diane suggests that in order to really understand a religion, we need to understand its historical dimensions, its historical context, its political dimensions, economic dimensions, and its and also its cultural context, both modern and in the past. And part of that is being familiar with the beliefs, customs, and texts and modern sort of practices of that religion, but to also recognize that religions themselves are internally diverse. So that one of the things that I say to the students in the class, you often hear the phrase the church tossed around, but in fact, there is really no church. There are how many, 400 or so different Protestant sects in the United States. So there are many churches, but not really perhaps one capital C church. The other thing I want to say really quickly that is very amusing from this week is that I actually take the appendix from Stephen Prothero's book, which is a religious literacy quiz, and give it to the students at the start of class. And it's amazing. It probably will not amaze you, though. They all failed the quiz. They can't name necessarily the four Gospels or where something comes from in the Bible, the Four Noble Truths, et cetera, et cetera. And it's funny because to go back to these office hours, when I ask the students, you know, what is a big idea that you're taking from this? One of them is, I really am pretty religiously illiterate, and I need to do something about that if I'm going to engage, you know, in society in a way that makes a lot of sense. So I'll stop there.
Do Prothero and Moore, are they making the claim that religious literacy, however they define it, you've showed us that they define it somewhat differently, but that religious literacy for them is so important, getting back to this idea of self-governance, that for us, the American people, religious literacy is a necessary condition of our continuing self-governance. Do they lift up religious literacy and think it to be that critical?
Yes, 1,000% yes for both. And in fact, I think both of them feel quite strongly that this is a component that should be taught more in schools. Strictly for the purposes of, if we look at some of the conflicts that we see in society today, dare I say it, if you look at, for example, how people view and are protesting for or against the war in Gaza right now, one of the things that you see, and there's a really great PBS documentary about this, by the way, that suggests that people really aren't aware of the historical context, both near and distant, that shapes the present war in Gaza. And in fact, that makes us much less effective when we come to talk with one another about what solution should be, for example, to that conflict. And this is the case for all kinds of things. Religious illiteracy, for example, it could easily be to blame for the rampant Islamophobia that was experienced after the 9/11 attacks in 2001. And there are so many examples of this where if we just knew more about religions, we might be better off. But I do want to add something here, which is really important. Prothero makes the case that there is no one religious literacy. In fact, because there are so many religions, we might call them religious literacies. And it would be really, quite frankly, impossible to be well literate in all the world's religions. So the big point I'm making to the students is, and this is really important when we go back to the topic of self-governance and living in a democratic society, religious literacy is not so much a status that you achieve as it is a skill set that you practice. And underlying that skill set is the central idea of being able to think critically and provide reason. And so I really encourage the students, as they're engaging with others about religion in the public square or anything for that matter, that they really need to do their homework and not just speak about things that they don't know, and then be able to cultivate the sense of self-awareness and humility to say, actually, I don't know, but I will go look this up so that we can have a better conversation. And those are some of the things that are underlying religious literacy. So I want to give us a chance to gnaw on that.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. That religious literacy does not simply mean knowing a lot of things about a lot of different religions, but rather, the way I hear you describe it, that Prothero believes that also it's a certain way of thinking or a certain habit of thought in terms of coming into, but that would be applicable to any kind of discipline or even any kind of conversation, that you would come in with, as we say in the One in God's Name podcast, curiosity and some humility. So there's nothing distinctly religious literacy about that, or maybe there is. I mean, I'd be curious. If it's applicable to all kinds of contexts, is there anything about it that it makes sense to say that it's about religious literacy, or is it just applicable to everything?
Well, I think the sort of underlying ethos is applicable to everything, but I think the reason that one might argue for a specific kind of religious literacy is that this is an area, and when I say this, I mean knowledge about religions, that is often left up to. So let's go back to a previous topic in the course that we've also discussed in this series, which is this notion of the Jeffersonian Compromise. So because religion is not often taught about, and I use and underline the word about, in schools and left up to the jurisdiction of denominational affiliations, churches, mosques, synagogues, the issue with that is that when it's not in any way standardized and taught in an educational setting that is not church-bound or religiously bound, what essentially happens is that means that the education about that is either uneven or some people don't get it at all. And so their overarching point is not just that these skills are important, but this is really lacking to be a good citizen in this country in the 21st century, knowledge about religion specifically. And that we shouldn't just leave it to the churches and the mosques and the synagogues.
And so that raises the question, or brings to mind a question I had earlier, but now is the time to ask it, which is, if Prothero and Moore are correct about how important religious literacy is, then they, I imagine, would say that profound changes need to be made in our educational system.
Absolutely. Yes, profound changes are needed within our educational system. And I think Moore would be even more emphatic that because she's written a whole book about this, that religion actually should just be taught in secondary schools. Now, of course, that becomes very tricky depending on which state in the context, but she would still emphatically say, yes, this is a subject about which should be taught in secondary schools. And in this case, in the college setting.
Yeah. So that's interesting. I mean, anecdotally, I remember in high school that there was an elective English course titled The Bible as Literature. So being cognizant of how religion can be taught in public schools and the distinction between the teaching of religion and teaching about religion, just the change of preposition is a significant shift in meaning. So anyway, that's just an observation, not a question. Anything more? Tell us more about religious literacy. I guess you've addressed religious literacy to the rescue. I mean, so let me ask you this. Can you say more about the rescue piece? What are we rescuing here if people are able to, achieve a certain level of religious literacy?
It's a good question. And note especially that this is more of a question than it is a statement. So the title of this episode might well be Religious Literacy to the Rescue. And I say that because of a couple things. Let's go back to the previous week where we talk about religion as a conversation stopper, where there's this really great discussion between Rorty and Stout. And where we are left is this notion that there's this sliver of hope where religion might be included in the public square if reasons are given. And remember that the big point here is that both Rorty and Stout seem to reject the place of religion in the public square where it is relying specifically on faith claims, the notion that, well, I believe this because it's written in the Bible or because God told me so. Those aren't reasons, and they're rational reasons in their vernacular. And so the reason that I asked the question is religious literacy, can it come to the rescue? Is because as we ended last week, we were talking about that Stuart Rosenbaum piece and how he advocates for a genealogical understanding of religion as something that is not monolithic, that is not existing in a vacuum, and that is developed over centuries, if not millennia. And if we can understand all of that as sources of reason for having an opinion that comes from religion, then we might make progress in the public square. And I think that is a nice follow-on. And it asks the question, can this be the answer to those reasons that Rorty and Stout are demanding that religious citizens bring into public conversations? But the reason that this is still a question is because does this necessarily get us toward better disagreement in the public square? I think the answer is that it's part of it, but there's something else that we'll cover in the next week where, I'm going to advocate for a sort of two-pronged approach. One of them is that students need to be more religiously literate. The other we'll talk about next week.
Oh, that's a tease.
That's a teaser. You always ask for a teaser. You've got your teaser early in the episode.
Before we get to that, I know we need to stop in a second, but and I'm not quite sure how to ask this question, but I'll just blurt it out and see if we can maybe even work with the question and refine it and see if we can make it better. But I'm going to blurt out this question: what would a conservative? I hate using that word in this context, but I'm going to use it because I'm blurting this out. A conservative Christian critique of religious literacy be?
I'm pausing to think about this for a second. Let me restate it. What would a conservative Christian's critique be of religious literacy?
Can I say more?
Yeah, let's say more.
So isn't there a certainly an epistemological, but even a quasi-theological, maybe even not even quasi-theological, but a theological stance that undergirds an openness to religious literacy and an openness to thinking about religion as something you can be literate about? I mean, I'm not sure a certain kind of conservative Christian commitment would would even go there. Like so it seems like there's a fundamental leap or a fundamental first step or a fundamental first assumption that is made that makes an approach to religious literacy even possible.
I think I'm following you, but we may have to talk this out a little bit. Let me say this, because I have a few conservative Christians in the class, and evangelical, at least one, and certainly a Catholic as well. So what I would say is, and I'm just going to sort of ad lib this for a minute. We'll workshop it. I think the leap that they probably have to take is, and this is purely conjecture, but it is a sense of knowing that they are right and this is the way for them, this being their Christianity, and wondering why I should even know anything else about anything else that may not even be real or right. These, in the way that I might view multiple religions as different paths up the same mountain, they only believe in one path up the mountain. So why should they do this, you're probably asking. That's it. Okay, good. So what I would say to this, and this is something that I think they would say too, because I've had conversations with at least these two students, is most of them, each of them rather, can set aside the assurance that they're right about the way up the mountain and it being the only way up the mountain, and still see at the same time and hold in tension the importance of being able to understand how other people from a religious perspective, or not, by the way, it could be humanistic or agnostic or atheist, see that mountain and seeing that there's validity at the very least in understanding it, even if not agreeing with it, because that's part of their civic duty. And I think that's the appeal of this. And what these folks do is they have to sort of modulate between knowing they're right and also being willing to hear that, even at the end of the day, and saying, okay, that's still not for me, but there's still value in engaging this and hearing these perspectives. And I think that's another reason why I asked this question, religious literacy to the rescue, because it may still be that for some of these folks who see only one way up the mountain, conservative Christians, as you've called them, who may say, so what? I don't want to engage in this religious literacy. Most have. But that's why I think we have to get to something else that can be used as an even more fundamental way of looking at the world, where we can actually see that there really are some strong overlaps and strong connections. And that's where we're going in the class. Does that help? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Thanks for workshopping that with me. And it seems like you've once again teased the next show. That so if I'm hearing you correctly, you've raised religious literacy to the rescue, ? And now what we're going to talk about next week is something else that also might be to the rescue. is that fair?
That's correct. And I'll just go ahead and say it for those of you who know it, is we're going to be talking in the class about Aristotelian virtue ethics. And you know, one might argue that that Christian ethics are based on those ethics, but we'll talk about that in the upcoming week. Those are my final words though. Great to be with you as always.
Yeah, great to talk to you, Brandon. Thanks so much. We'll talk next week.